Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Bob Geldof, good morning. You're very welcome.
Thanks, Brendan. Thank you.
How are you, Bob?
Sort of recovering from all the stuff I've had to do over here because of the rats. 50th sort of anniversary birthday and the launch of albums and stuff like that. So, Brendan, I'm not the best for wear this morning, but thanks for filling me in on the news.
Yeah, okay, you're all caught up now. So does it takes its toll a bit more at this stage of life, does it, when you're 50 years in the old rock and roll?
Yeah, I mean, I flatteringly got from Sky Arts, I got a Lifetime Achievement Award the day before yesterday, but in showbiz terms, that's the gold watch. It's there to go, mate. Can you bugger off now?
Yeah.
The trouble is I got one of those when I was 40 as well. So it was, can you please go away now?
Yeah. Okay, they'll give you another one next year. Now, they'll start coming more regularly now, dropping the hint heavily. Listen, so 50 years of the Boomtown Rats, extraordinary to think that. And there's a compilation album, the first 50 years, Songs of Boomtown Glory. And actually, Bob, when you put that all those songs together, that body of work, it's extraordinary how many fantastic songs he had. And not just what a great rock group you were, but what a great pop group you were as well, because a lot of them are really great pop singles. How are you feeling about it yourself, 50 years of the Rats?
One, it's as you know, and anyone listening knows, time telescopes itself. So, you know, sitting in that bar, sitting in that pub just before we went into the classroom in Bolton Street College of Technology on Halloween night 1975, it was yesterday. Honestly, it was yesterday.
Really.
And we got up and we did some huge festival at the weekend there. And it's the same sense of excitement. You know, but when that band starts up, I could be talking to you exactly like this or anyone else. And then you walk on stage and that band starts. And I just get lost in it. And it's a sort of cathartic thing. All the everyday stuff, all the jumble of life gets pushed aside for 2 hours, and there's a clarity and a looseness in your body and your mind. And it just seems like I want that, or I need that. And I listened to the album, the Songs of Boomtown Glory, coming down to Kent in the car yesterday, and it was song after song that it's not that I forgot writing them or I didn't know. It's just when you hear them, as you suggested, en masse, you kind of think, is that what you spent your last 50 years doing? And the answer is yes. And then you think, not bad, son, not bad. It'll do.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you've done a lot of other things in your life as well. But listening to you there now, is the Boomtown Rats your greatest achievement? Is it the thing you're most proud of, do you think?
That's a really good question. The pride thing doesn't really happen to me. That sense of, like, you know, that doesn't, I can only really, even with the children, like, you know, I love them to bits and I'm thrilled when they do well and like everybody else, or if I do something that people say, that's great. But the sense of pride in it doesn't really, it only happened once, and it's in a very obscure sort of civil service thing. I persuaded Blair to analyze why Africa remained outside the global economic common wheel. And I had to push like crazy. And eventually he agreed to do this thing called the Commission for Africa, which was the heads of state of the North, global North and South, including Chinese and Americans, and a lot of economists, the majority of Africans. And it sat for a year. And I participate in that. I was one of the commissioners. And then I persuaded him to adopt it for the 2005 G8, and then had to organize Live 8 to push it through the World Bank and the IMF. And that whole trajectory was exhausting, but it got done.
So did you allowed yourself, even in your Irishness, a moment there to say, I did that. Not bad.
I'll tell you what, it's the report itself, Brendan. Like, you know, I never passed an exam in my life, but that year and that report, I was determined not to let it sit on a civil servant shelf. I was determined it would be enacted. And but the report itself is really great. And, you know, I was proud of that. That's what I was proud of. So the rest of it, the rats is will stand to me, I think, in what Bob did, you know, what he felt, what was natural to him, what came natural to him was that. You know, don't forget, I was working in the slaughterhouse in Bald's Bridge, and that was the only job I could get in 1970s Ireland. And, you know, to try and have a bit of fun, we get together in the shed at the back of the flat where I was living. And next minute, it's, you know, there's 50 years of a band, and it's celebrated in lots of places, you know. I mean, the tour and all that sold out and that. And it really is weird. It really is a weird thing, because we had the number ones, and we had the hits. And as you rightly said, it was a pop band, but it was a pop band with purpose. Songs like Rat Trap and I Don't Like Mondays were about stuff.
Yeah.
And when you get to number one, we were number one, I think, in 34 countries. When you get to number one, people are singing the song, but then they kind of go, hold on, what's that about? And again, pop music is a really powerful thing. You grew up listening to your bands. People today are growing up listening to their bands. And there's brilliant bands coming out of Ireland now, you know, controversial, causing a fuss, just like Sinead and U2 did. And it seems to be a thing we do. You know, we use this powerful medium exactly like Elvis and Little Richard did to make a fuss, to create a noise, and to talk about things that aren't just pop, but about articulating what the hell is going on with you and within society at that moment. That's what makes it a sort of a living, powerful minor art form.
Yeah. So to that, just for the background, because I think a lot of younger people won't realise how important the Boomtown Rats were to us at a particular time in Ireland. Shock the young crowd by painting a little picture of the Ireland 50 years ago that the Boomtown Rats came out of.
It's very hard to, you know, it's very boring for younger people, for people like me, to go, oh, it was awful and you've got it lucky, you know. The truth is, it was awful. It was awful. And I apologise to people of my generation who had a different experience. But the first thing to remember is that economically it was zero. I mean, absolute zero. There was nothing for our generation. And, you know, part of me thinks that if a government cannot give its younger generation a future, then it's almost a treason. But to put that in context, inflation in the UK in 1975-76 was 27%. There's no point. There's no point in having a job. There's no point in trying to get food in the shop, because the prices will have just become ridiculous. New York, the richest city in the richest country in the world, declared bankruptcy. So this was going on. And of course, then you get bands out of New York like Blondie and the Ramones, and you get the Sex Pistols and the Clash.
Yeah, England, but Bob, as well, I suppose. But you coming out of Ireland, was there something as well that they didn't so much have in the UK and the US, which was Ireland uniquely oppressive for young people?
Yes, it was. I mean, that's the word you're using. There was this great sort of social claustrophobia, and it came about, I think, and this is, people go Geldof crapping on again, there was intense political corruption. The government was funding and fueling the killers in the north. The fact that there's killers in the north infects a sort of virus into society, where fellow islanders are being murdered, and the government fueling this and therefore almost secretly endorsing it. The business people kept quiet about everything because they were too busy enshrining their contracts with government. And the church, as we all know, largely silent except for a few brave priests in the north, were, you know, busily abusing the children of their parishioners. And when the Boomtown Rats was pointing this out, you had a paedophile like Casey in Galway standing up and railing against us. Our speeches in the Dáil and stuff like that. When we first got on telly on the Late Late Show, and I thought it would be the only time I'd ever be on telly, or the lads would be.
Yeah, so it was 1977, like, wasn't it? Just to give people context. Yeah.
So we started talking like this, and the next day at Mass in Glasthool, my dad was at Mass, and the priest got up and he did his sermon, and then at the end he starts saying, pray for the soul of that poor, demented young fellow on television last night. His father is here with us, and he's probably ashamed. And my father stood up and told him to shut up.
Did he?
That he wasn't ashamed of his son. And all the congregation clapped. Now, that really is an indication that Ireland had had enough.
Yeah.
Just enough.
Do you remember what was it you said that night that really kicked things off?
I don't really remember. I mean, RTÉ have scoured their tapes. Bono says, like, he said it in interviews, that he was sitting there with Googie, his artist friend, as kids. And they just gripped the side of their chairs and they were going, at last, at last. And Sinead was this young girl in Dunleary, and she skipped around the room. You know what I mean? But we thought, this is it. All of us, because Gay said to the rest of the band, he goes, he's had his say. What do you lot think about it? And they said, we agree with them. And the thing about the Rats was, we came out of the exact same conditions. Listen, Brendan, the only job I could get was, what's it, in a slaughterhouse. The only thing, when we started playing and very rapidly, you know, this crowd built up around us, very different to the local sense. So when we arrived in the UK, we weren't out of joint with what was going on here. There was, as we now know, this general cultural shift. They called it punks, but actually it was just a generation of young people who were offered no future, and they were determined to make one.
And
so,
just before we get to England, were the Rats basically cancelled by Ireland, official Ireland, after that late show?
By 1980, absolutely. It came to a head when, you know, we were really proud to be the first Irish band ever to get to number one in the UK charts. It's hard enough to get to number one, but to be outsiders and to get to number one, you know, and to be Irish outsiders in the middle of the killings and the murders and the kidnaps and the torturing, and to be Irish here is very much like to be a Muslim right now. You know, you're sort of targeted. Our people are okay, but they sort of get a bit leery if, you know, you see someone dressed differently with a bag and they leave it down. It was the same. So to get to number one and be Irish, and if anyone bothers to look at Top of the Pops, when the DJ says it was hard, they made it all the way from Dunleary, they got there, it's number one. I'm wearing a tiny little tricolour on my lapel.
And you point to it at one stage.
Yeah, I do. And, that's the one time where I will overtly admit that what's it, on television, that I'm Irish, I'm proud to be, and we did it despite everything. So then we come back with our triumph to lay at the feet of our supporters at home. And it's a big gig. It's Leopardstown Racecourse. And the Pope had just been. So this is the high pitch of the Catholic Church in Ireland. But our dressing room is the same tent that the Pope used. I mean, this is almost laughable. And somebody kicked off that we were violating the same space where the Pope got out of his trousers and was hanging around in his underpants, changing into his gear. And the Boomtown Rats were going to be in the same tent doing the same thing. So instantly, our public health insurance was withdrawn. Now, if you don't have public health insurance, you can't do a concert because something might happen to a member of the audience or something, and it needs to pay out. So we stayed. We went to court day after day. And we said, we're not leaving Ireland until we can play in our own country. Now, this actually almost bankrupted us because it was our first world tour. All the big stuff had gone ahead to America, the big staging and that. But we hung on. And there were speeches in the Dáil against us. We went to court. The court struck us down. We really didn't understand what was going on. But this sort of silent opposition to the establishment, which I wasn't really aware of, built up. Eventually, at around, the courts don't sit at the weekend, at midnight on Friday, RTÉ, who were supporting us tacitly, RTÉ announced, if you've got tickets for Leopardstown Racecourse, they will be honoured tomorrow at Leixlip Castle. Desmond Guinness had given us the use of his castle for £10,000, which in 1989 was £10,000, or 1979, 80. And I thought, good, we'll have done something. We'll have stayed. We'll have played our own country. Maybe 300 people would show up, because who listens to the radio or telly at midnight on a Friday? I woke up at Bloom's Hotel, walked down to the quays in Dublin, and every bus said Leixlip Castle. And there were thousands of people. And they got out of their homes in Limerick and Cork and Galway and Mullingar. And they had their ticket, and they hitchhiked overnight to get to Leixlip Castle. And 20, 25,000 people got there. And our crew dug toilets and built a stage overnight. The local rugby club would do security. It was a horrible gig, Brendan. You know, we were exhausted. The sound was crap. I mean, people who were there said it was amazing. But,
there's people texting in remembering that day. I don't think anyone young listening to that would believe that this is the country. This was back in 1980.
I think it was a change moment. There was a different Ireland emerged with purpose. They left their homes at midnight to get to us. Yeah. But I was exhausted with the whole thing. I'd had it. And we drove to the airport after the gig, and I stayed in the airport until the plane. And I began writing the song Banana Republic, which is bitter. But if you want to know what the place was like living then, that song sums it up. And it's on the first 50 years Songs of Boomtown Glory album. And I listened to it because, I played it the other night, but that's different. Yeah. I had to listen to it yesterday in the car, and I thought, not a bad tune. It works.
Yeah, totally, totally. The Rats made an excellent documentary with Billy McGrath a few years ago, Citizens of Boomtown. I was kind of surprised, Bob, because I remember it as one of the best things ever to happen in Ireland in my youth, the Boomtown Rats, right? And I do think that people who are 5 years older than me grew up in a different country with a different experience because of that, the 5 year difference of me growing up in the Boomtown Rats Ireland. It just felt different. But I thought the documentary portrayed the band as a failure ultimately, that because he didn't crack America, and that in some way that soured the whole thing.
I'm thinking about what you said, Brendan. Give me a minute.
Yeah.
I don't think we viewed it as failure. We viewed it as exhausting. We started in Ireland. We got to a place in Ireland. We started in Britain. We got there. We got to Europe. We got to Australia. And finally, we go to America after the Banana Republic incident. Now, again, you must put everything in context. Did the Sex Pistols and the Clash and the Stranglers and the Jam and all those bands break America? No, we didn't. And the reason why is because the Americans were completely involved in disco and sort of hair rock from Boston and California at the time. So when these antsy kids showed up, in this Pistols case with torn clothes or whatever, they really didn't get the attitude at all. They didn't get the rage and the anger, because America wasn't experiencing that except in New York. Their economy was doing okay. And so when we showed up with this aggressiveness, they didn't want to know. Plus, the radio was just doing, as I said, disco and stuff like that. Don't forget, for the Rats to get to number one with Rat Trap, John Travolta and Olivia Newton-John were 1, 2, and 3. It was this sort of blockage in the charts that we had to be the sort of diuretic that swept aside. So we get to America. It's big in New York. At the gig, Jagger was at the gig, John and Yoko were at the gig. It was that sort of thing. We came in on a wave of success. But once you're in America and you start touring, it is huge and it is endless and it is exhausting. So you're in some club in Boise, Idaho, some punk club where there's 100 people. Meanwhile, you're number one in 12 other countries. And you're going, what am I doing here? So here's the thing that happened. Almost immediately after my generation, a new thing was invented called MTV. I did the second day of MTV. I did an interview in a garage, and it was a cable station that was playing to Brooklyn and the Bronx locally. That's all it went to. And I said to Tom Freston, who became and still is the boss of MTV. I said, do you think this thing is going to work? And he said, yeah, I think so, because cable's big in America now. So that was that. But following us came Duran Duran, the Eurythmics, Boy George, all these very glam, stylish pop groups. And of course, in America then, you got style really for the first time, except for Elvis and, say, the Beach Boys and Dylan. You got Prince, Madonna, Michael Jackson. If MTV had existed when we arrived, my generation...
So it was a matter of... It was probably a matter of 6 months, was it?
Exactly.
And you made such great videos. You were pioneers in that too, so you would have been perfect for MTV.
Yeah.
Bob, did you also kind of then... Then obviously, look, we'll skip along a bit. Yeah. Did you have to accept then in 1984, the Rats were still together at that point, but that you become Band-Aid Bob, and does that take over everything? I don't know if you remember the last tour, the In the Long Grass tour. You played in the City Hall in Cork. And I was 15 and it was amazing. I was seeing the Boomtown Rats for the first time and all that. But there was a sense of a slight sheepish. He passed out buckets, I think I remember, for Band-Aid and stuff at the time. And there was a sense that this is who I am now.
I mean, I'm really amazed that you can remember all this and that you describe it so well, because that's exactly right. Band-Aid had happened. People were now coming to us because it was Band-Aid Bob, not Bobby Boomtown.
Yeah.
You came because it was Bobby Boomtown. You wanted to hear the tunes. But people kept viewing me differently. And the venues themselves asked, listen, can we, you know, put out buckets for money? And suddenly, like, you know, it's like the little black baby box in the church, you know. We couldn't refuse because, you know, Band-Aid was huge at the time. So that was it. And the other thing, bear in mind, was that most of my contemporaries had now folded. The bands, they'd lived for that eruptive moment, 77 to 79, and they, you know, they'd broken up or whatever. But we kept going, and the big rock and roll program at the time was The Tube. My missus was the host of that with Jules Holland. So we knew all the new kids coming along in Thatcher's Britain. One way you've got to view my generation was the first thing you ever heard Bob Geldof and the Boomtown Rats say was, the world owes me a living. The first thing you heard Johnny Rotten, another Irish boy, say was, there is no future in England's dreaming. I am an anarchist. I'm the Antichrist. Joe Strummer of The Clash. White Riot. I want a riot of my own. It was all about I. And that was because in the post-war world, there was this consensual politics, the unions, business, politics had to group together to rebuild out of the ashes. But that came to a head with this 27% inflation, or the only job we'll give you is a slaughterhouse. That came to a head. And so this generation said, I want something different. I want a future. Nobody expected that revolution to come from a woman, from the right, and with a handbag. So Thatcher swiped at her own party, the squirearchy in the UK, the opposition, the trade unions, the monarchy. She was, in effect, a sort of punk politician. One of the things I say is that one way to view Margaret Thatcher is that she was, in fact, Johnny Rotten in drag. And then Thatcher's children are Duran Duran, Boy George. You know, their videos are all about yachts and dancing in the sand in Rio and stuff. So they come along, but we know them very well because Paula knows them from The Tube. The Rats are still on The Tube. They come down to my house. They stay at weekends. So we're still kind of part of that. And my thinking is, I observed Phil and Thin Lizzy, and Phil always tried to get on with the new thing, whatever it was. And he lost his way. And if he just kept going as classic Thin Lizzy, he would have made it through the trough, and he would have come out the other end, as they did, and be recognized as one of the great rock and roll bands. And that was what my lesson was. You keep going. And what's it? You go through the trough, and then you'll come out, because just keep writing good songs. In the meantime, one late October night, I turn on the telly and see something that makes all of those considerations null. It just puts it into perspective. And then I do the, I write the Do They Know It's Christmas song with Midge, and then something else, just this phenomenon happens. And I have to go with it. There's, you know, yeah. I said, you know, I'd do it. And so 40 years later, just before speaking to you, Brendan, I turned on my mail, and there's another 11 mails of horror that I have to deal with today. So, you know, the rats, Band-Aid. So when you saw us, that was that moment. And you, your sheepishness is a brilliant, brilliant word to describe, am I Bobby Boomtown? Am I Band-Aid Bob? Are we doing music that's for now? That confusion was what you heard in Cork.
And, yeah, I've seen you say certainly becoming Captain Africa was very confusing for you. And like, you looking back on the that excellent Band-Aid Live Aid documentary recently. So we didn't know what White Savior was back then. But one of the startling things about it was you got grief even back then. Like, you couldn't win no matter what you did. Like, when you went out to Ethiopia, for what you were, a young man who had just tried to do something good, you really copped a load of flack, didn't you, as well?
Yeah, because, like, you know, who's this amateur, you know, who's this, that, and the other. The point is that if you're... I'd stepped outside my allowed constraints. I was a pop singer, whose band wasn't doing fabulously. In the Long Grass is a really good album, but it was struggling like crazy. But the thing is, once I went on TV, once we'd done Band-Aid, and you go on Terry Wogan, you can't say, and Terry's saying, and what's going to happen with the money and all this? You can't say, and by the way, here's our new album. You just can't do it. So, and I couldn't say, and we've got a new tour coming out. So I couldn't talk about starving children and the Boomtown Rats new tour. That's ridiculous. I couldn't do it, and I didn't do it. And so we floundered. Now this thing becomes a phenomenon. I said every single penny will go to somebody directly who needs it. And that's true, and it's true to today. No one in Band-Aid has taken a cup of coffee or a phone call out of any of that money. It goes directly. And 40 years of that. So when I went there, I was still, in the public's eye, this loudmouth Paddy, you know, shouting off about Ethiopia. But we've been alerted by 24-hour media. And I could, whether I liked it or not, I was now, as the press said, the guy who had to keep the story going. If I didn't go, they could not keep doing the same story about exhausted mothers and starving children. They couldn't keep it going. So the story is you, Bob, and it's your responsibility, isn't it? And I've had that, Brendan, for 40 years. I've had David Cameron, when he got to be leader of the Conservatives, called me on New Year's Eve and said, I want you to sit on the Tory Party Poverty Policy Group. And I said, well, I can't do that because I'm friends of the Prime Minister and, you know, he's completely on board with this agenda, Gordon Brown. And he said, but isn't it your job? I said, what do you mean? And he said, isn't it your job to inform me? And it's likely I'll be the next government. And if I get there, I will use what you put into the Poverty Policy Group to enact as law. And meanwhile, in opposition, I can raise this against the Prime Minister, who will be forced to do more. Isn't that your job? Isn't that what you said you'd do?
Okay, yeah.
So I'm confronted with this the whole time.
And I've seen you say that a Live Aid-style concert could never have the same impact again, and that rock and roll maybe doesn't matter as much anymore. But you alluded there to the new crop of Irish bands, the likes of Kneecap, Fontaines D.C., CMAT even. They are political acts again. Gaza seems to be politicising a new generation, maybe the way Africa politicised you. And it does seem that music can be a powerful weapon still, doesn't it?
You know, I think what everybody learns is that music of itself changes nothing. But it is the clarion call since, what's it, you know, the Pied Piper. And it can gather, it can articulate, as I said earlier, it can condense and articulate in an acceptable form something that is universal. And all those three bands you mentioned played with CMAT on Halloween, on New Year's Eve, and Hootenanny on BBC. And she was absolutely compelling. Played with Fontaines at All Together Now. Great band. But my kids, you know, growing up with me and me going on, they sort of engage but not engage. Palestine has really engaged them to the point of fury, the same fury that I felt, when I was 13 about stuff like apartheid, when I was made about that, when I was aware of that, and working with the Simon community in Dublin and seeing the unnecessary poverty and, removal of people from society in Dublin. So all of that really enraged me, which informed the Rats. But my kids are out on the marches. And, at every gig, I would bring up directly Palestine. But I would say it and then I'd put it in the context of a tune. When the purposeful starvation of children became a weapon of war for Netanyahu, then I can speak. That's my subject. Otherwise, I'm Johnny 40 opinions in the bar. No more valid and no more powerful than anyone else, but sharing the same opinion.
Yeah,
but
I think when people saw those pictures from Gaza of starving children, it did cast everyone back 40 years ago, didn't it? Bob, there's a few other things I want to get to. Can I ask you as well, given that it's the thing that's immediately on our plate this morning, you've been in the media and TV business for years now, and you've always spoken your mind. We talked earlier about being effectively cancelled in Ireland. What do you make of the Jimmy Kimmel controversy and Trump's seeming now determination to clamp down on critical media?
Well, you know what I think. You think the same, and everybody who's sane thinks the same. Our democracy stand or fall by the expression of our opinions. That's it. And everyone has the right in our democracies to say precisely what they want. I go back to the Boomtown Rats' first appearance on the Late Late Show. And we were allowed to say what we wanted. And Gay Byrne, masterful, conducted this. You'd have a juggler, you'd have the Boomtown Rats crapping on, you'd have a politician, and the audience back then were booing us, etc. But Gay, I remember, said, hold on, let the poor fella have his say. You know, that sort of stuff. That's what should happen with Jimmy Kimmel.
And that was in the oppressive country we've outlined earlier. That's what the media was allowed to do.
He's terrified. You know, Trump is terrified of opposition. I mean, the Democrats are failing. Where are they? Where's the policy? Where's the language that combats Trump's banalities, his vulgarities, his stupidity? Where is the language that argues against a different economic bromide? You know, where is this? I mean, and Kimmel and Colbert and all these people are the only opposition. The only thing I could say is that they're preaching to the converted. They're already talking to a constituency that agrees. But it is, I mean, look, this is a cliche, and even saying the words make people wince because it's such a cliche, but it is out of the classic fascist playbook. First you take the courts, first you take the election, then you take the courts, then you suppress the media, you know. They are how many friends do you have in the States who are frightened now, who are wiping their
WhatsApp? I think this week has been a tipping point for people, weirdly. Like the troops on the streets and lots of other things didn't kind of focus them, but somehow this week has focused them in a different way on what's going on. So listen, were you thinking of becoming president of Ireland?
No, I was asked flatteringly.
By whom?
Look, somebody said to me, and I said, yeah, 50 years of the Rats, 40 years of Band-Aid. I really would like to do something new, interesting and useful. So then they said, why don't you run for it? And I thought, and there's three things coming down the track that Ireland will need to negotiate. Very, very dangerous for Ireland, three of them, unless it's navigated properly. And the president will have a really essential role in helping the country to do so. So I thought, yeah. But the truth is that if you don't get a party nomination, as you just read out at the top of the show, it's a marathon to get there. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. It's we've just talked about the ascension of democracy.
So could you have seen yourself as a Fianna Fáil candidate following in the footsteps of Dev?
shut up. I have a view about De Valera, believe me. It might not
so
be
if Fianna Fáil hadn't had a candidate at that point and they said, you're a candidate, you would have gone for it,
probably.
Oh man,
I'd have done well, Brendan.
I think you would have done all right. And listen, obviously the texts are coming in here now. I think it would have been okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
how do you feel about Ireland? How do you feel about Ireland now?
I couldn't do the county council hurdle race. I really couldn't do it. I just don't have the time. It's been wall to wall. Putting the tour together, putting the album together, the promo for it, and the daily stuff I have to do.
But if you got jumped straight into a campaign, you would have done it. Wow.
I would have, because here's the thing, and this is where people go, for God's sake, grow up. I'm contracted to do these shows. So I'd had to do the rats, which I'd have loved. That would have cleared my head, jumped on a plane and come home. Campaigned, but honestly, Brendan, you get deluded. It's flattering to be asked, and then you think, do I want that? Do I really want that? So here's the thing: I think the Irish are very ambivalent about me. I think the county councils would have been a nightmare for me. The Shinners would never, ever, in 1,000 years, put a vote for Bob Geldof. So the others are sceptic, like, who does he think he is waltzing in here, so-and-so. Well, lay out your stall, lay out the beauty parade, And my thing is, if you don't know what I've done, then there's nothing I can explain to you. There's nothing I can say that explains why I would do those things. So either like it or you don't. And plus, I wouldn't have had the time. So I'd have enjoyed the scrap. I'd have enjoyed the debates. I'd take anyone on, I don't mind. But I honestly think I probably, and this is not a false modesty, I honestly think I'd have been beaten. But I'd have gone into it. That's never bothered me. I would have gone into it, but there's a great ambivalence about me.
And what about you and your ambivalence to Ireland? How do you feel about Ireland now?
I go back to your earlier part of the conversation. In the history of countries, the change that happened to Ireland was so of an instant, was so radical, was so brilliantly achieved. I used to say, that when Gay retired, I did one of the speeches, and I said that all of us of our generation suspected and knew there was a different Ireland that was there, a clever Ireland, an intellectual Ireland, a thoughtful Ireland, a sympathetic and kind Ireland, not the begrudgery, not the smallness of this country. And you would find it on a Friday night for 2 hours on a television show called The Late Late Show. That sounds extreme, but I said Ireland was like a deep diving whale that was allowed to breach for 2 hours every Friday night. And we were allowed to talk about abortion. We were allowed to talk about homosexuality. It was the weirdest thing. And that was where you saw a real Ireland. And the rats were part of that.
I speak on behalf of so many people when I say that you are such an important figure in the life of people my age, because, as I say, I got to grow up. In that real Ireland, in that new Ireland, and I don't have any of that bitterness that people of your generation have, because they don't need to, and I think a lot of it is down to you. There are literally hundreds of texts demanding Bob for president, I'm being told here. So I don't know if there's a way around this, but you're willing, yes? You're willing.
Of course I'd be willing. What an honour. But the thing is, listen, here we go. So here's honestly, Brendan, between you and me only, okay?
Yeah.
I had an image 18 months in and the novelty's worn off. And I've asked the government, can I go back to see my kids in England? and the grandkids. And I'm staring out the window, a big window in a big house. And it's Wednesday afternoon, 3:30, and it's cold and it's damp and a bit foggy and the dark is coming in. And I'm looking out at Phoenix Park. And I'm thinking, is this really what I wanted to do in the last lap of my life? The honor is beyond immense to represent a country and a people. That's ridiculous. And I'll do it, and I could do it, and I think I'd have been a really good, everything I've done would come to a head. All these people I know and have met and have negotiated with and have written far and done policy far, everywhere, that would come to a head. But honestly, is that, you know, it's been me, I'd enjoy the challenge, I'd enjoy the scrap, I'd enjoy the argument.
You're trying to talk yourself out of it now, live there. I can tell from where the energy is. I can. You're keen. You were keen, and
shut up.
And you are keen.
Shut up.
Okay, and obviously I am not allowed to express any opinions on who should be presidential candidates or who any of them are here on Radio Éireann, but there you go. I think a lot of people will be listening to that and wondering.
I hear you.
What did Yeats say that time in the Abbey Theatre when the people rioted at the, was it the Plough and the Stars or something? You have disgraced yourselves again.
You've disgraced yourselves again.
Okay. So Bob Geldof, the greatest president we never had, thank you so much. The album, The First 50 Years, Songs of Boomtown Glory, is out now. And listen, despite everyone electrified by the last 45 minutes of Bob's conversation, go back and listen. Go and listen to that album, I would say. And any young people, go and listen to that album. It's as fresh, those songs are as fresh as they ever were. And it's a fantastic body of work. Bob Geldof, thank you so much.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.